the mind is, as we have been trying to understand, a total force of what we ourselves are, and not something outside us requiring an external observation or an outward mode of contact. Philosophers from centuries onwards have been trying to discover the proper relationship between the mind and the self, the mind and its objects, etc. And everyone has differed from everyone else. There is rarely a unanimity of opinion among thinkers on this subject. The difficulty lying precisely in the enigmatic character of the mind. It has been held, for instance, that the mind is a synthesizing, intelligent element lying at the background of all sense functions. And according to this doctrine, the mind is nothing but an organizing power which does not introduce anything new to the reports of the senses, but merely collects them, arranges them, and gives them a shape. Generally, in the process of the knowledge of any object, three stages are involved: sensation, perception, and cognition. In the beginning, there is what is known as a sensation of an object. You begin to have a faint idea of something being there in front of you. As we say, I sense something. But not sensing merely in a psychological form inside, but externally, the senses themselves begin to have an inkling of something being in front of them. Very, very indeterminately, generally, and without any kind of specific identification of the object. When this sensation gets more concretized by intensification of attention on what is being presented in front, it becomes a perception of such and such a thing. Here, the mind is silent, though it is sitting at the back of the senses. And when the perception is complete, the mind begins to act. It conceives. It directly acts upon the senses and connects intelligence with a bare perception of the senses. It is here that the trouble really takes place. That when intelligence is connected, we ourselves are connected, because we are intelligence. Our essential nature is intelligence. You may call it by any name: intelligence, consciousness, understanding, awareness. All these are various synonyms, meaning almost one and the same thing ultimately. We ourselves seem to be drawn towards the object. When the mind begins to cognize the object through the senses, the mind synthesizes the sense perceptions in this manner. For instance, the eyes see a shape and a color connected with the perception with the eyes of shape and color, there can be a connected perception of sound through the ears. The skin or the tactile sense may feel a sensation of touch, of a solidity or a substantiality of the object that has a shape, color, etc., as visualized by the eyes. It may have a taste, it may have a smell, etc. Now, one sense cannot do the work of another sense. The eye cannot hear, the ear cannot see, etc. But the mind can bring all these together and focus it on a single perceptual data. Then it becomes a complete awareness of such and such an object with so many complex characters. The five senses act like five agents, bringing five different types of reports regarding one and the same thing. And these five reports are brought together into a single consciousness of five aspects of the given object. And the mind begins to perceive that the object is one, though the reports are five. Then, of course, many other processes take place inside judgment, etc., which is the work of the intellect. After all, what is the purpose of this perception of the object? And what is the intention of the mind in synthesizing the perception, sensation of the senses? To pass a judgment, ultimately, what is to be done now? Such a thing has been seen with such a character. Oh, I see, now the intellect says, this is a snake, I will run away from this place. No, judgment has been passed. To find out that it is a snake, so much time has been taken by the activity of the senses and the synthesizing function of the mind. Or it may be some pleasant thing, oh, my mother is coming. Then you will be so happy, you go and prostrate yourself before the mother. If it is a tiger, you run away from that place. Varieties of judgments are passed by the intellect in various ways under different conditions, as the case may be, as you all know. Now the mind is a peculiar intermediate principle between the object outside and the pure self within. Many thinkers have felt that there is no such thing as the mind. It is only the self that is acting directly upon the senses. But others held that this kind of doctrine has a defect in it, because the self, if it is immediately connected with the senses, there will be perpetual perception of objects. And there will be no such thing as non-perception of objects. Because the self is permanently there. It has no modifications, it has a uniform character, and if it is connected directly to the senses, you will be aware of things always. There will be no time when you will not be aware of them. But there are occasions when we can perceive and non-perceive, etc. So the attention and the non-attention that we bestow in respect of objects has made people feel that there is something else functioning between the essential self and the objects outside, and that can be called the mind. Now, what is this mind? Is it a quality of the self, an attribute like greenness, blueness, etc., that you see in a flower, a blue flower means a flower with blue character, attribute, quality. A heavy object, a blue flower, a sweet dish, etc., is what we speak about when we characterize things. Now, is the mind a character, an attribute, a qualification, an adjunct of the self? Just as blueness can be regarded as the attribute of a flower. This again has driven people to great controversy, inasmuch as it is difficult to come to a definite conclusion. Because it is difficult to conceive the relationship between attribute and substance. This is one of the great problems in philosophy. What is the connection between quality and substance? That peculiar term we use, namely inherence, does not explain matters. Because inherence is only a way of expressing the inseparability of the attribute from the substance. But yet it does not mean that the attribute is the same as the substance. We never say that the attribute is identical with the substance. The attribute is a peculiar condition of the substance. Or rather, to put it more precisely, the attribute is a condition under which the substance becomes an object of cognition, etc. We become aware of an object under certain conditions. These conditions, which are responsible for that specific perception of an object, become what we call the attributes of the object. This would amount to saying that the substance has itself no qualities, because these qualities are only certain characteristics perceived by the subject under certain circumstances. So if the circumstances change, perhaps the attributes will not be there, so that certain other attributes will be perceived. So can we judge the self and the mind in this manner, that the mind is an attribute of the self? Then, if this sort of definition is to be applied, we have to concede that there can be circumstances or conditions under which alone the mind could be located as existing. There are no conditions or there is no circumstance where we can imagine when the mind is absent. Yesterday, we were trying to find out the various levels of self, layers of our personality. And under every condition, in every level we found that the mind is operating. Even in the deepest layer of self, there is an element of mentality. The attempt of yoga in controlling the mind thus involves many an aspect which ultimately is connected with one's own self. It cannot be controlled as long as the proper connection of oneself with things outside is not understood. Because the control of the mind is nothing but a regulation of one's relationship with things. That itself is control of the mind. Because on a careful analysis, we will realize that what we call the mind is only a conscious relationship with externals, which create sometimes an unconscious background, a residuum in the form of potencies, latencies, or as we call them in Sanskrit, samskaras or vasanas. Conscious perceptions can produce memories which can lie in an unconscious condition. So, it finally comes to this, that any attempt at the restraint of the modifications of the mind, control of the mind, is tantamount to a proper understanding, evaluation and organization of our relationship with externals. Because the very precise function of the mind is contact with externals. And the judgment of externals as certain values connected with oneself. We feel a necessity for controlling the mind and therefore arises the necessity for the practice of yoga, because it has been observed that the usual types of relationship which obtain between oneself and objects outside are not always conducive to the happiness of oneself. And all these relationships appear to be untrustworthy modes of contact and undependable sources of satisfaction. If a particular object of sense on which the mind and the intellect pass a judgment by way of relationship and contact is really dependable for all times, very trustworthy, then it should be so for every person in the world, and even for one and the same person for all times. It has been seen by experience and observation and experimentation that no object in the world can be regarded as having an identical or uniform value for all people, for all times, and even for one and the same person for all times. It goes on changing its attitude. Or rather, one changes one's attitude towards it for reasons difficult to understand. So it means that there is something very inscrutable and difficult about one's relationship with things, which makes one conclude that there is a necessity to probe deeper into the subject. The aim of life is freedom from sorrow, complete abrogation of all pain, and an establishment in the hope for perennial joy or eternal bliss, which seems to be an impossible thing in this world on account of the unintelligible relationships that the mind has with things upon which it pins faith, which it regards as the source of its satisfaction. Two questions arise here. Is the object of sense really the source of joy? That is one question. If that is the case, there will be justification in the mind hanging itself upon an object for its joy. But is it true or is it not true? Is a question to be answered very dispassionately. The second question is, why is it that an object which the mind imagines to be the source of its satisfaction changes its characters constantly and makes it feel miserable at different periods of its life? These are very profound psychological issues. Before we try to bestow some thought upon the various methods of control of the modifications of the mind, which is the main forte in yoga, it would be essential for us to go into this subject, whether any object of sense upon which the mind and intellect pass judgment is a source of joy. Is it true or not true? This has to be carefully investigated into. Then secondly, we have to find out why is there a constant anxiety felt by oneself in respect of an object, and there is a subtle insecurity and joylessness even at the time of experiencing a so-called joy in one's contact with an object. Even when you are enjoying an object, there is an unconscious unhappiness at the background for other reasons which the mind is not consciously thinking at that time. The object of sense cannot be understood easily because of there being a preconceived notion of the mind in relation to the object. No understanding of anything is possible if you have already a preconceived notion about it. You have to shed this preconception or prejudice first. You always say, oh, this is very good. If you already said it is very good, then I have nothing to say about it. I will keep quiet. First of all, you have to be very dispassionate and a little more general and impersonal in your making a remark about a thing as good or bad or useful or otherwise. But the mind is not amenable to any kind of investigation of this kind, because the essence of mind is prejudice. It is born into it and it is stuck up into that peculiar mold into which it is cast. And it is this prejudice that is another name for clinging to objects as sources of real value. An object becomes something very difficult to investigate because of this prejudgment that the mind passes upon that thing we call the object. The mind always tells us it is there, the matter is closed. If it is there, why are you going to question about it now? Is it there or not? I am telling you it is there. And you should not put another question. The question that arises regarding the existence of an object may be due to a doubt in regard to its existence. But the mind says there is no doubt, it is there, I am seeing it. And also I am experiencing a peculiar reaction from it. This reaction from the object, which comes through the avenues of the senses, is the cause of the conviction arising in the mind that the object is outside there really as a substantial something. But all this so-called conviction of the mind in regard to the existence of an object is an outcome of a misconception, a kind of confusion, a muddle. A muddle is something which you cannot intelligently investigate into. But this is what has actually happened. The object is, according to the perception of the senses and the conception of the mind, something which would not permit of logical analysis. One of the strong points about the objects of sense is that they would not allow any kind of investigation. Because if you subject them to scientific analysis or logical investigation, they would slowly begin to lose their ground. Like the investigation of the activities of a thief. The thief would not like to come to the forefront. He always lies at the background, not being perceived, because any kind of investigation into this background of the life of that person would be a source of insecurity and unhappiness to that person. So the strength of the object is precisely in its inscrutability, anirvachaniyatva, as they say in Vedanta philosophy. You can neither say it is there, you can not say it is not there also. And in classical analogies, they give the example of the rope and the snake, for example. When you see a long rope twined up, lying on the road in twilight, you mistake it for a snake. You may jump over it in fear, imagining that it is a snake. You have seen a snake. If you have not seen it, you would not jump. Now it is not there. So it is possible to see something when it is not there. But the seeing of something when it is not there becomes possible under certain conditions. So these conditions have to be examined. What are these conditions under which certain objects can be perceived even if they are not there? various factors in the case of this analogy, lack of sufficient light, or a memory of a snake that one has seen earlier, and so on and so forth, umpteen causes are there. So likewise, there can be certain sets of conditions which can generate in the mind and a perception of something outside as an object. The reality of an object lies in the conviction of the mind arising out of the judicious synthesizing of the reports of the senses which it has done and which it regards as logically deducible from facts given. If something can be regarded as having a color or a shape, if something can be tangible, if something can have other characters exciting the activities of the five senses, that can be regarded as an existing object. But why does something excite the senses? This is a side issue that arises on account from this investigation. What makes an object endowed with the capacity to excite the senses in a given manner? We have a very simple answer given in the Bhagavad Gita, Gunaha Guneshu Vartante. The reason why an object stimulates or excites the sense is due to a similarity of character in the structure of the senses, and that's something which you call an object outside. Go back to the Sankhya and background upon which this statement has been made by the Bhagavad Gita, Gunaha Guneshu Vartante. Guna does not mean a quality, but a pattern or a structure of things which is supposed to be the substance of every object. What is intended here in this statement of the Bhagavad Gita is that thing out of which the senses are constituted is the very same thing out of which the object outside also is constituted. So there is a pull of one thing in respect of the other. The senses run towards the object, and the object evokes the activity of the senses on account of a similarity of structure. The same structural pattern is present both in the object outside and the senses inside. These substances which make up the senses and the object are called the gunas. The gunas are peculiar technical terms in Sanskrit, meaning certain properties. These properties of objects are also the properties of the senses. These properties are sattva, rajas and tamas. Sattva, rajas and tamas are gunas or properties, and to explain to you what it actually means would bring you to the substantiality of the object and the substantiality of senses themselves. Rajas is a condition of absence of equilibrium. Any state in which there is disturbance, agitation, division, tension, tendency externally may be regarded as rajas, or you may call it what you call kinesis. The kinetic condition of an object is rajas, whereas the static condition is tamas. In our scientific studies or studies of physics, we talk of kinetic or dynamic condition of things and the static condition of things, but there is no talk about the third aspect which the Sankhya and the Bhagavad Gita speak of as sattva. We don't know what it means, because such a thing is never seen in the world. Sattva does not exist anywhere outside. Either a thing is dynamic or it is static. That's all. the condition of dynamis and statis. Is after all a condition. We must remember that. Very aptly, the word guna has been used here and we translate it as property. It is not a substance but a condition. When we say something is inert, we refer to a condition of that something. When we say something is active or kinetic, we also refer to a condition of that something. Now, can we say that substances are made of merely conditions? This is very strange indeed to say that, because we always say that a condition is of something. A condition is of a substance. Now you are saying that the substance itself is nothing but a collocation of conditions. Otherwise, why do you use such words as property, guna, etc.? The Sankhya philosophy and also the Buddhist psychology of momentariness or the transiency of things have concluded after deep thought that the substantiality of things is ultimately inseparable from a condition in which these things find themselves. This is corroborated by scientific analysis also, as has been done in these days. A condition, though it cannot be and should not be identified with the substance itself, somehow or other seems to be inseparable from the characterization of the substance by sensation and cognition. We cannot say what a substance is except by definition of its condition. We have never seen a substance minus its condition. Whenever we speak of a substance, an object or a thing, we always speak of a particular characteristic or a group of characteristics or a set of circumstances under which that object, so-called object, is supposed to be. So that we can safely say that though we speak of a substance or an object or a thing, we are really speaking of certain states, of some certain conditions, of certain reactions set up in respect of our senses. And finally, the judgment in respect of the existence of an object seems to be the same as the judgment in respect of an experience that has been produced within us. What we speak of a substance or an object is nothing but an experience of something being there. If the experience is not there, the object also is not there. So now, we have come to another difficulty. From the difficulty of not being able to differentiate a condition from the substance, we have come to another difficulty of it not being possible for us to differentiate the so-called existent object from an experience of that object. So we have a double difficulty, one objective and another subjective. We shall think of it a little later on. Hari Om Tat Sat.